and welcome to Ethics and Business Law. I'm Todd Colkin. I'm a solo practitioner here in the great city of New York. And today we're going to go over maybe my favorite topic to teach of all time, which is making sure to balance the entrepreneurial spirit that lives within every business attorney with the ethics rules. So with that said, let's get started. What's our agenda today? We're going to be going over many of the major rules of professional responsibility. There's going to be a lot of chapter and verse here. Apologies, that's a little dry. However, we'll be applying those things to the to business law. I think it'll be enjoyable ultimately. So we're going to start with confidentiality, moving on to conflict of interest. We're going to talk about the anti-solicitation rules and networking. We're going to go through the no contact rule, which is surprisingly important for business law. You'd think that that would have more to do with litigation, but in fact, when you're dealing with represented parties and unrepresented parties in a transactional setting, because it could be considered adversarial, because there's one side versus another side, even if you're trying to work together towards putting a transaction together, the no contact rule still applies. So it's really important. We're going to go through referral fees, both when dealing with non-attorneys and sharing legal fees with attorneys. We're going to talk about commuting with unrepresented persons. We're going to go through attorney as third party neutral, which is something that doesn't happen super often in my practice, but does happen, and we'll go through that in detail. We're going to go through some trust account issues. No, it's not going to be the usual draconian, don't do anything with your escrow account, otherwise you'll be disbarred every time, all the time. Don't do it, don't do it. But there are a couple of pitfalls that are not obvious that are really important for you to understand if you're like me and you're a solo practitioner and therefore, run the escrow account and everything else in your practice. But even if you're part of a larger practice, and you deal with the escrow account in any capacity, it's important to know these rules. And we're going to talk about non-law practice activities next. Now, what does that mean? We're talking about the rules of professional responsibility. Why are we talking about non-law practice activities? Well, because and I'll touch on this briefly now and then later on more in detail, but because lawyers deal with so much of humanity, since the law is that wonderful thing that touches every part of humanity, and a lot of us are entrepreneurial in nature, we tend to go do other things, right, in addition to being attorneys. Just as an example, I run a consulting practice as well as a law practice, and keeping those things separate and making sure that the rules of professional responsibility only apply to the law practice are exceedingly important. We'll talk about it in detail. And then finally, we'll talk about the concept of should you take equity. Very, to me, it's a very important point. It's an important issue because I deal with a lot of startups and I get offered equity all the time. Sometimes in lieu of compensation, sometimes in addition to compensation. So we'll go over that in detail. And finally, some Q&A. I see this is being recorded, so if you have any questions, obviously you can't, ask them live. However, you can always email me at todd@colkinlaw.com, or you can give me a call. My contact information is on the top slide. That said, let's get started. So, on to confidentiality. So, first off, it's Model Rule 1.6. It also happens to be New York Rule 1.6. Now, I happen to be a New York attorney. I'm only admitted in the state of New York. So I'm going to make reference to the ABA model rule as well as the New York rules, especially when the New York rules diverge from the model rules. Super important. But here they don't. So let's get into it. So first little chapter and verse. A lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent. What does informed consent mean? That means, just like in the medical profession, it means that you have gone through every implication of the disclosure with the client, and you've gotten their consent. Now, technically speaking, you don't need it in writing. However, you would be kind of dumb not to get it in writing. Or alternatively, if you're on a conference call, I happen to do this all the time when I'm on a conference call with a client and say a potential joint venture partner or an investor or something like that. I when a topic comes up that I think is a little sensitive, I say, okay, so and so, I, you know, this is a recorded conference line, so I can ask, like, do I have your permission to talk with so, you know, with this other person on this conference call about topics X, Y, and Z? And usually the answer is yes. Usually I talk with them before I ask them that permission on the recorded conference line because, you know, you never want to ask a client a question you don't already know the answer to, but, you know, it's still important to do it. But anyway, that's considered informed consent, especially if you've gone over with them beforehand. So, continuing with the chapter and verse, the disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation, or the disclosure is permitted. So, the idea of impliedly authorized is a little dicey. Now, if you're dealing with a disclosure in litigation, well, that's pretty obvious, right? You just, you know, the only way you can do the representation is if you make the disclosure. But usually, I don't rely on the impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. I mean, that's a catch-all. But what I generally rather do is get the informed consent. Now, in litigation, that's a little more cut and dry. In business law, it's a little less so, especially when you're dealing with things like trade secret. Now, this is super important. It's not something that gets talked about in many ethics lectures, but I think in the business law context, it's really important to get into it. So, as many of you probably know, a trade secret is a type of intellectual property that is not otherwise protectable by registration, either as patent or trademark or copyright. And the strength of a trade secret, or rather should I say, the enforceability of a trade secret of infringement in court is only as strong as the secret-keeping mechanism itself. And by the way, that includes attorney-client privilege. So whenever I'm dealing with a trade secret, let me just give you an example. So one of the companies that I work with is a waste-to-energy company, and their pricing structure for what their machines cost and how much money they are able to receive from the grid, you know, per kilowatt hour, those are considered trade secret. And so sometimes it's nearly impossible to, you know, to help to work with the client, or rather should I say, represent the client in, on a conference call or in a meeting without mentioning those things. However, it's really important that you get that kind of permission from your client beforehand. So when you're dealing with the trade secrets, here's what I generally do. So first off, obviously, if you're on a conference call, it's really easy to just say, okay, you know, it's a recorded line. Can we, you know, I just need to get this consent. Or alternatively, you can send out an email to the client beforehand, say, I want to be able to talk about these topics. Is that okay? All as well as with the trade secrets, specifically, as a rule, I don't talk about a client's trade secret unless the person, the third party, meaning the non-client or myself or someone associated with my firm, has already signed a binding non-disclosure agreement, because that is the secret-keeping mechanism for the trade secret. And so if you disclose a trade secret to a third party without that third party having signed a non-disclosure agreement, well, it becomes really difficult to enforce it, the trade secret in court in case that third party goes around trying to you know, trying to use your client's trade secret for their own benefit. So just to recap on that, when you're dealing with something highly sensitive like trade secret, make sure that the other side that you're disclosing it to is under NDA first. And also make sure that you have a either written or audio recorded permission from the client to make that disclosure. Okay, now going down to Rule 1.18, this applies to the initial consult regardless of representation. Now, in the litigation context, this gets a little hairy because sometimes people will go, especially in, say, matrimonial law, they'll go from matrimonial attorney to matrimonial attorney doing lots of initial consults to make sure that they're would-be ex-spouse can't be represented by any of the, say, best attorneys in town as they perceive it. In business law, it's a lot easier. So When you're doing an initial consult with a client, you let them know that the initial consult is confidential, that you know, you're not allowed to disclose anything to a third party. But at the same time, you let them know that you need to be aware, and the client needs to be aware, of what is in fact confidential and what isn't. Because the crux of confidentiality and privilege is the question of, did the client and the attorney mean for it to be a privileged conversation or a privileged email or a confidential call or something like that? Now, what a lot of folks do is they just put the words confidential all over every email, every phone, every piece of paper that they send out, and that doesn't really work. I remember back at my old firm, I had to do these confidentiality checks for the litigation folks. And so we'd have to go through thousands of emails where the word confidential and the word privilege showed up in the email, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the information therein was considered privileged under Rule 1.6. So, you know, be careful about it. Don't just slap the word confidential on something to try to keep it from third parties. Make sure that it's clear that the intent is for attorney-client privilege and for the, it's a matter of getting legal advice. Okay, moving on to the next slide. So, startup confidentiality issues. This happens a lot in my startup practice and also from a more established business client. So let's go through it. So business model information. This goes back to the trade secret related stuff I was talking about earlier. You know, business model information is almost always entirely confidential unless you are dealing with a business model that is entirely public facing. Just to give you an example, any company that uses a subscription model. And when they say, what's your business model? We use a subscription model and nothing else. Okay, that's public facing. It's not entirely confidential so long as it's public facing. So unless that client's business doesn't have their website live yet, in which case, technically speaking, it's confidential. Stuff like that, that's pretty obviously publicly facing, you don't have to worry about. Now, when you're networking on your client's behalf, this I like to do all the time, and a lot of business attorneys, you can add a lot of value as a business attorney when you're out there in the world and you're meeting all different kinds of people, and it just so happens that you have a client who, could benefit greatly from meeting, one of these people, or maybe the people that you're meeting would greatly benefit from meeting with your client. So when you're networking on your client's behalf, make sure that, and look, it's hard to do this in a casual conversation, but there are a couple of techniques that are helpful. Technique number one, it's like, oh yes, my client, the client for my law firm does X, right? If you start that part of the conversation that way, then it's pretty clear that there's an attorney-client relationship. Then when they start asking questions about things that are problematic for you, or rather things that maybe kind of walk the tightrope of confidentiality, or maybe go off that entirely, you say, look, I'm sorry, this is my client, I am an attorney, I do have a duty of confidentiality, I can't answer that question, but I know my client can, so why don't I just make an introduction over email or introduce you over a phone call or something along those lines so that the client can answer your questions directly. Now, if the person you're networking with is worth their salt and a good person, then they'll generally say, oh yeah, that's totally understandable. I would want my attorney to say the exact same thing if they were talking to someone else about me. If they keep pushing you, well, then you already know maybe you shouldn't be interacting with that person, or maybe you shouldn't be introducing a client to that person, especially if that client is, really close to your heart. So moving on to trade secrets, we discussed that previously. However, it's worth noting again, the secret-keeping mechanism is the strength of trade secret protection. So when you are dealing with, you're talking about something with a third party, or you're in a meeting or a phone call or whatever, and a trade secret comes up, like specifically, If you don't already have permission to ask from the client to divulge that trade secret, what I generally do is I say, if I'm on a phone call or what have you, okay, the question that you asked, I cannot answer it without divulging a trade secret. Client, you're on the phone. Is it okay if I, divulge this thing? And they'll say yes or no, and you deal with it. Next, patentable items. Now, patents by themselves are public-facing documents, right? So you have to, when you register a patent, anyone can go on to the USPTO's website and look up your patent. So, technically speaking, what's in a patent isn't confidential because it's public-facing and anyone can access it. However, if you have if your client has a provisional patent, if your client is currently patent pending, or they're in the application process, this is the most sensitive time for a patent because until they actually have the patent, there's no protection. So if what you're discussing with a third party is potentially a patentable item, make sure that you're not disclosing the secret sauce, the thing or things that make the process, patentable or novel or what have you. Now, finally, confidentiality when discussing matters with a client in public places. Remember earlier I said that the crux of attorney-client privilege in general is, do they intend to keep the thing privileged, to keep it secret? So when you're discussing something with a client in a public place, and this happens in my world all the time, either at a conference or in a board meeting or just hang out at a Starbucks or at dinner or something, and we're in a public place, there are two things that I would ask you to do to try to protect confidentiality. Number one, make sure that you and your client fully understands that when you're in a public place, it is impossible to completely guarantee privilege. So that's number one. Number two, you make sure that wherever you are, you're sort of in a secluded area and that the two of you keep your voices low. In other words, do everything that you can to make it difficult for a third party to listen in. If you do that, then it's clear that the attorney and client have intended for something to be privileged. And if a third party happens to be listening in by sort of invading your space, and if you don't know about it, you've still kept your duty to your client while at the same time, done everything you could. We go on to the next slide. We're going to move on to conflict of interest. And this is something that happens, that comes up all the time. So let's go to the chapter and verse. So the New York and Model Rules, it's 1.7 through 1.10. The definition, the following. The conflict of interest is where, one, the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client, or there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. So let's start with number one, because that is way less complicated than the second. So this is pretty obvious. If your representation of one client completely is adverse to another, usually in the litigation context, that's really easy to tell. Like, you can't be the plaintiff's attorney and the defense attorney at the same time. It's not quite how it works. But in the business law context, it can sometimes be a little murky, especially when you are representing competitors with each other, which we'll discuss in a later slide. And number two, the significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by your responsibilities to another client, a former client, or your personal interest. So this is one of those catch-all type of scenarios where you're supposed to exercise your better judgment, which is sometimes difficult to do, especially when you're using terms like significant risk. Like, what does that mean? Does that mean, is it 25% likely? Is it 50% likely? Is it 65.265% likely? Who the heck knows? But if you work on a principle that, and the way I like to do it is a simple smell test. right? If I'm representing different parties, or I have a, usually this comes up when a new client comes into the fold, and I have to ask myself, would representing this new client competently, not zealously, because the standard is no longer zealous representation, it's competent representation, but if I were to competently represent this new client, and I would have no reason not to, would that harm other, you know, these other clients? Will it harm my personal interest? If I have to jump through hoops to say no, then I see it's a potential conflict of interest. And then the question is it waivable? If, however, it's pretty easy for me to say, no, it's not a big deal, great, no problem. However, if you do see a potential conflict of interest, it is generally quite helpful to just have the client sign a conflict of interest waiver. Make sure that when you do that, you have informed the client of a potential conflict, and you can be honest with them, as you should at all times. And sometimes I even tell my client, look, I don't think this is an actual conflict of interest because of X, Y, and Z. I think your interests are aligned with me for these reasons, but I don't even want the specter of impropriety. So I would like you to read through this conflict waiver. If you have any questions, let me know. If not, sign in front of a notary. Now, there are exceptions to the conflict of interest rules. Let's go through them, more chapter and verse. Number one, the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. Again, this asks you to use your better judgment, ask yourself the questions, and make sure that you answer yourself honestly, because it's just a general matter of human nature that we all lie to ourselves in some capacity. So if you can, be honest with yourself and say, will I be able to competently represent, persons A, B, and C at the same time without their interests diverging? If you, can't answer yourself honestly, and by the way, it takes a real mensch, like a real person, to recognize that particular problem in their mind, then speak with an attorney that you trust, or you can call the ethics hotline. I know New York has an ethics hotline. Most of the state bar associations have an ethics hotline, which, by the way, is a super helpful tool that, especially for solo practitioners like me, if there's ever any doubt or you have a question, it's always great to be able to just call the ethics hotline, and an attorney who's on that committee for that bar association will call you, and you'll talk through the facts, and they'll say, well, this rule and this rule applies, and sometimes they'll give you direct advice, sometimes they won't, but it's a really helpful way to bounce an idea off of someone else. Again, if you're part of a bigger firm, then this may not be as helpful to you unless for some reason you don't want to speak with your partners about it, which, depending on the situation, may make sense. But for those solo practitioners like me, it's a really great tool. Anyway, going back to it. So number two, the representation is not prohibited by law. That's pretty self-explanatory. Number three, the representation does not involve the assertion of a claim by one client against another, represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceeding before a tribunal. Okay, this is clearly just based on litigation or arbitration. However, it may also apply in a business context if you reasonably believe that the interests of the different parties in a transaction, if their interests completely diverge. Now, you may be asking yourself, wait a second, if there are multiple sides in a transaction, then aren't their interests just by their very nature diverged? And the answer is maybe, as always, but depends on the type of transaction you're working on. So a good chunk of what I've been doing in the last couple of years are joint venture agreements. In joint venture agreements, if you structure it in such a way that the interests of both parties are always aligned, right? First of all, that's a much better joint venture agreement than one where they diverge. But number two, it helps solve your conflict of interest issue. However, if you do so, Make sure you follow number 4. Each affected client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. What does that mean? Well, it means that you have to, you know, speak with each one individually, or you can speak with them together, about, you know, what the potential conflict is, you know, how you think it can be resolved or not resolved, etc. And then technically speaking, you can get an email or some other kind of confirmatory writing saying, I waive this conflict. However, I would highly recommend that you use a conflict waiver form that your firm has, or you can just shoot me an email and I can send you mine. Okay, moving on. So business conflict issues. Some of these are obvious, some of these are not. So number 1, representing a client's competition. Now, depending on the nature of the client's businesses, might not be a conflict. So just to give an example, if you represent multiple online subscription services that say do meditation apps like Headspace or something like that, depending on the nature of the representation, it might not be a conflict. If you're a marketing attorney and all you do all day long is analyze advertisements and other forms of marketing to make sure they're compliant with the regulations, it doesn't really matter that you're representing multiple clients in their competition, because you're not really the interests of one don't exactly harm the other. Now, if you're representing a former client's competition, that's where you need to be really careful, because it's quite easy when you're currently representing multiple clients to keep them all in your mind. However, when you're dealing with a new client or a current client and, you know, who is competitive with a former client, it becomes a little more difficult, because remember, these rules in general, all the rules of professional responsibility, they are not there to protect us attorneys. They're there to protect the clients, and therefore we get lots and lots of duties to folks that we might not necessarily want to have duties to, and one of those is former clients. And there is no such thing as a client who is former enough that there's no duty to them, even though, you know, that might not be considered, you know, fair or equitable, but, you know, that's a story for another day. It's an argument for, you know, you and me over a drink if you want. But when you're representing a former client's competition, think about where your former client is. If your former client is out of business, clearly it's not a big deal. If your former client is still in business and it's an active competition, then you will need to consider that more heavily. Now, number 3, negotiating both sides of a transaction. I really don't like doing this. Technically speaking, you could do it, and there is a case study that we're going to go over in a few moments, which is an example of how not to do it. But technically speaking, you could negotiate both sides of a transaction if you have these if you have the potential conflicts of interest waived. I would say don't do it. Obviously, this is a calculus that you as an attorney need to make.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is REMOTE. REMOTE, REMOTE. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is REMOTE. REMOTE. Please take a moment and write this down.
Make for yourself, but I, in my experience, it's never worth it. Right? It's usually just much better to say to one of two things to them. So look, we can do this one of two ways that makes sense for my duties as an attorney. And by the way, if you reference the rules of professional responsibility, and you say these are the rules that we attorneys have to follow, and it's for your benefit, not mine, generally speaking, the clients will either acquiesce or they'll just respect it. So I'm going to say we can do this one of two ways. Either one, we can do this with attorney as third party neutral, which may be impossible if you've already represented one of the other sides of the transaction in the past. Or alternatively, you could, I pick a side, the other side, you know, gets an attorney and I work with that other attorney, right? If you, if you absolutely must negotiate both sides of a transaction, I mean, technically, you could theoretically do it. Your insurance company doesn't like it when you do it, by the way. Then what you could do is you can get conflict waivers, and then also when you have confidential conversations with each of them, you make sure they stay separate. But again, that is really hard to do. All right, moving on. So sometimes these conflicts can be waived. Sometimes they can't. You have to ask. Now, finally, the importance of informed consent to waive a conflict. I think I've harped on this enough, but I'm just going to say it one more time. So, you know, so long as you've gone through and had a conversation with the client about what the implications are, and you have them sign a proper conflict of interest waiver, generally you're okay if things go awry in the future. If you just do one but not the other, that causes an issue. Again, remember that these rules aren't here to protect us. They're here to protect the client. So if, say, you just have the client sign a piece of paper that says, I'm, you know, giving informed consent to, you know, to this potential conflict of interest, so I'm waiving the conflict, and then later on down the line, that client gets upset and, say, you know, goes to the grievance committee, and they ask that client, well, you know, you signed this waiver. And they say, yeah, but the client didn't explain to me what it was. Guess what? That's enough for the conflict of interest to be a problem for you. So do both steps, please. Learn from my experience and my mistakes. I will just keep it at that. Make sure you do both steps. So now let's move on, albeit briefly, to what happens when you sort of when you violate the rules, or rather, you know, what misconduct looks like. So Model Rule 8.4 also happens to be New York's Rule 8.4. So here's what we get to the fire and brimstone. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer too. Violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional conduct, or knowingly assist another to do so, or do so through the acts of another. Obviously. Anyway, let's keep going. Commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects, which I find really funny because theoretically speaking, you know, any criminal act, you know, misdemeanor or felony, should be, you know, considered, you know, reflecting adversely on the lawyer, you know, on the lawyer's fitness as an attorney. However, not everyone sees it that way. Next, engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Now, this is a, it seems rather obvious. Keep in mind, though, that there are lots of ethics opinions out there which state that if you knowingly or unknowingly help your client engage in dishonesty, fraud, or deceit, you're still liable under Rule 8.4. So it's not just you; it could be, you know, helping your client do so, whether you know it or not. So engage in conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice. That's, you know, rather that's, I guess it's vague enough to work. State or implying ability to influence when properly a government agency or official to achieve results by means that violate the rules of professional conduct. Quite simply, don't say that you're going to bribe somebody, or don't bribe somebody in general, because it's one thing to say, well, we have a strong lobbying group at our firm and we might be able to get this done for you. It's another thing to say, oh yeah, I know the governor. I'll take him out to a really nice dinner. I'll slip him a check, and then he'll do what we want, or she'll do what we want. Not helpful. All right. Knowingly assist a judge or judicial officer in conduct of violation of applicable rules of judicial conduct. I don't know when anyone would do that, but then again, I don't litigate very often. So, you know, if you have any stories about something like that, you know, definitely give me a call. I'd love to hear it. And finally, engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status, and conduct related to the practice of law. My God, it's just the general catch-all. Don't discriminate. However, you are allowed, and this is the second portion of this of subsection G here. You're allowed to accept, decline, or withdraw from representation, so long as it's not discriminatory in nature. That's really important. Okay. Now, New York Rule 8.4 goes like this: a lawyer or law firm shall not one. I'm sorry, A, violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional conduct. Okay, sure. Second, you know, the honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness, engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Starting to sound real familiar, right? Engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice, or state or imply an ability to influence improperly, you know, a tribunal, a legislative body, or achieve results using means that violate the rules of other law. So that's really similar to the model rule, right? But keep in mind that this section of it anyway, you know, doesn't have all the same detail that the ABA model rule uses. Then we move on to the next slide. Now, knowingly assist a judge, just like before, unlawfully discriminate. All right, so that's a little different from engage in conduct that the lawyer knows is harassment or discrimination. It says here in the New York rule, unlawfully discriminate. So if any part of New York law allows you to discriminate, well, I guess that doesn't really apply now, does it? Now, fortunately for for most people, New York doesn't really have a lawful discrimination, but you know how it's usually helpful to scrutinize the letter of the rule, especially if you're dealing with this stuff on a regular basis. And finally, engage in conduct that adversely reflects on the lawyer's fitness. That's the catch-all. Yeah. I'd like to go through a real life case study, and this is maybe the closest thing that I will ever do that comes close to throwing shade at another attorney. You know, something happened a couple of years ago, and the facts are stated here in the real life case study that really boiled my blood, really got under my skin. And I wanted to, instead of doing something that I would probably regret later, and you scrubbed all the names to protect the innocent or not so innocent as the case may be, and put it in this presentation so that other attorneys can learn from this other person's issue. So let's get started. An attorney in the state of Minnesota, we're gonna call him Mr. S. S stands for Schmuckadoo, by the way. Doesn't matter, not relevant, just is what it is. Represents both sides on the purchase of privately held stock in a publicly traded company. So we're starting with representing both sides, all right? So when you do that, you know, you have to be really careful about it. You gotta get your written conflict waiver. Consideration for the purchase of stock is a down payment and a promissory note. Mr. S does not obtain a written conflict waiver from either client. Uh-oh, we have a problem. 1 year later, the purchaser misses their payments, and Mr. S brings an action against the purchaser on behalf of the seller. So what do we have here? We have, you know, Mr. S is bringing an action against one of his clients on behalf of another client. At the same time, we have a problem. Now, purchaser brings a counterclaim represented by separate counsel against the seller and sues Mr. S personally for malpractice, as he probably should have. Now, as the litigation begins, Mr. S advises the seller to rename himself CEO of the company and begin operating it again, since he knows that the purchaser, the rightful CEO, has no personal interest in running the company. This is why we have the misconduct rule about doing deceitful things through a client or advising your client to do deceitful things. Here we have an attorney who's represented both sides of a transaction without getting the waiver. He then brings an action against one client on behalf of another, and then says to one of his clients, you know, technically you don't own any of these shares anymore. However, I think you can go ahead and pretend that you're CEO of the company for the sake of the company. You know, that's an issue. And finally, to fund the litigation between purchaser and the seller seeks a loan from a third party, Mr. G, for quote unquote operations. All right. This is a, clear, deceitful act. Mr. S decides to represent both sides on the loan agreement without getting a conflict waiver. Loan agreement stipulates as collateral shares in the company that Mr. S knows the seller doesn't own and are subject to that initial litigation. Mr. S does not inform Mr. G, who is also his client, of that fact, and places a warranty that the shares belong to the seller in the loan agreement and gets his client to sign it. And here's the part that I just don't understand. Mr. S is the notary on the loan agreement for both parties' signatures. Let's move on to the next portion of it. So during settlement negotiations, Mr. S, representing the seller and the purchase of the same shares, we're going to call it the new purchase by Mr. G, who believed until now that the shares were in the seller's possession. During the negotiation of the new purchase, Mr. S reveals the truth to Mr. G's attorney, who's me, by the way, that the original purchaser owns the shares and that the shares are, there's a typo here, but learned that they're held by a litigation lien. When I asked him about the loan agreement, Mr. S stated that he drafted it but wasn't aware of whether it was signed or not. Meanwhile, Mr. Schmuckadoo here was the notary on the loan agreement for both party signatures. So really, he was being deceitful on multiple fronts here, in a way that is just so easily determined by just looking at a document. I mean, part of the reason why, actually, I think almost the entirety of the reason why we attorneys can become notaries just by signing a form and paying a small fee is because it's understood that attorneys will not abuse the notary stamp. And this is one of those places where he's abusing the notary stamp. He's using it and then, pretending like it never got used. Now, the big question, to what extent did Mr. S violate the rules of professional conduct, both the model rules and, say, the New York rules? Well, let's go through what we've been discussing so far. First off, confidentiality. He was using the confidentiality of one client to help the other. Conflict of interest on multiple fronts in the initial transaction, because he was representing both sides without a conflict waiver. In the litigation, because he was helping one side of that initial transaction litigate against the other. Third, in the loan agreement, because he knowingly misrepresented the facts about an inducement to entering into that loan agreement. And finally, in negotiating the final sale. All of these places, there was a conflict of interest, because at every stage, he tried to represent both sides. So in the initial transaction, he tried to represent both sides. Litigation, he was harming the other side. In the loan agreement, he again tried to represent both sides. And then in negotiating the final sale, he was trying to pit one against the other. And finally, the misconduct rule. In fact, the reason why I put 8.4 in the slide and made sure to go through in excruciating detail is to show exactly where you can, folk can fall into those pitfalls. So, what did he do? So he engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, or deceit, and misrepresentation. He, violated the rules of professional responsibility, knowingly assisting or inducing another to do so, or through the acts of another, he did through his clients, and he engaged in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Now, that phrase, administration of justice, is, just vague enough to work, as I said before, and because it's just vague enough to work, it applies to all of these things. So, as my wife often tells me, don't be a schmuckadoo. So learn from the case study of Mr. S and make sure that you are not, that you're not putting yourself in harm's way in this way. Make sure that if there's a potential conflict of interest, you get informed consent. Make sure that you don't try to represent a current client against a former client in litigation. I'm sure you litigators out there are laughing to yourselves because a conflict study a conflict check would never let you do that, but this guy apparently wanted to do it. And finally, don't be a schmuckadoo. Don't notarize an agreement and then pretend like the agreement wasn't executed. All right, enough of the fire and brimstone. Enough. I'm going to get off my soapbox. I appreciate your indulgence of my sort of personal little vendetta here, but I do hope that the study of Mr. S is helpful in applying these rules. Let's move on to the anti-solicitation rule. So, New York and Model Rule 7.3. Let's go to the chapter and verse. A lawyer shall not, by in person, live telephone, or real-time electronic contact, solicit professional employment when a significant motive for the lawyer's doing so is the lawyer's pecuniary gain, which, by the way, I find very funny. Because unless you're dealing with pro bono, why wouldn't the significant motive be for the lawyer's pecuniary gain? Like, why wouldn't it be that, again, unless you're doing it pro bono? Unless the person contacted, one, is a lawyer, right? Because these rules don't exist to protect us, they exist to protect the client, or has a family, close personal, or prior professional relationship with the lawyer. So the idea is you're not supposed to openly solicit and bother other folks in soliciting representation to them. Now, that isn't to say you can't market or advertise. That's something that we're going to go over in the next slide. However, it's still important to understand that that the unsolicitation rule effectively is the no cold calling rule, right? So if you're cold calling somebody and asking for a professional employment, either as an independent contractor or as an employee, that's not going to work. If you're calling a family member or a close personal friend or a current or prior client, I happen to do that all the time. I'll call a client that I haven't heard from in a while and say, hey, is there anything going on? Is there anything I can help you with? That's okay. If I call someone random who I've never had any contact with before and say, hey, I'm an attorney, I'd like to help you with whatever, that's another problem. Now, networking within the rules. Now, look, we attorneys, especially business attorneys, we're out in the world all the time, and we're always networking. Actually, the litigators network too, I should be fair to them. And when you are networking and you're in person with somebody, you know, one of the laws of sales is to always ask for the sale, all right? But the unsolicitation rule says you cannot ask for the sale if the contact is cold, if it's a first-time contact. So when I am networking with with anybody and I see that there's a potential client over there, and it says, hey, I happen to be an attorney, I could theoretically help. This is not the right place to talk about it. If you want to have a free consultation, we can do that. But, we'll talk about it later. That's especially helpful with the live seminar problem, which is if you're giving a seminar or you're taking a seminar in person and then you're networking after and, you know, everyone's trying to give each other business. And just be aware that you cannot give a cold seek of employment. You cannot ask for the sale right away. So what you do is when you've met somebody and you think they might be a potential client, you can say, oh, let's see how we can help each other. Or you can say, you know what, I might be able to help you with your particular issue, but this is not the time to talk about it. Here's my card. Just give me, here's my card. We can just, talk about it in general sometime in the future. Moving on to advertisements and marketing. So model rules 7.1, 7.2, and 7.4. Rule 7.1 is the catch-all of no misleading others. And by the way, that's the general regulation for marketing and advertising anyway. But if you're running a law firm and you're, for some reason, putting out a misleading advertisement, it would really stink to get regulatory, a hit from a regulatory body on the marketing side, and then also get hit by the Bar Association for misleading under Rule 7.1. So just, don't do it. Now, 7.2 allows for media advertisements and payment for advertising services. Now, that wasn't always the case about, 30 years ago. Attorneys weren't allowed to advertise at all, and then the rules were changed so that you can advertise on general media, and you're also allowed to pay for advertising services or for placements in the media. Rule 7.4 is representations of practice areas. Technically speaking, you are not supposed to say that you are in a practice area where you're not. Now, that's kind of obvious, but what's not obvious is you're not allowed to say that you specialize in thing X or thing Y or thing Z unless you are certified by a court in your local jurisdiction to be an expert or specialist in thing X, thing Y, or thing Z. Here's the problem. There are not many business law related topics that a court will say you're experienced in or you're an expert in or you're a specialist in. What I do instead, to the extent that I do marketing, most of what I do is by word of mouth, but to the extent that I am putting out a blog post or an email that could be considered advertisement or anything like that, I always say experienced in practice area X, Y, Z. It's kind of a silly semantic point, but then again, a lot of these are silly semantic points. You deal with it. Now, there are two ethics opinions of notes, at least in New York. So social media posts, I put out the citations, you can take a look at it. Essentially, it's the New York Ethics Committee saying that social media posts that are considered attorney advertising must follow the same rules as any other form of advertising. And finally, online reviews. Opinion 1052, it's pretty clear. Online reviews are also sometimes considered attorney advertising. But the point on this one that I want to make sure to bring to bear here is that it's a violation of the rules of professional responsibility to have a client give a review or a testimonial about a matter that is not concluded yet. Now, which is it's a really tempting thing, right? Things are going really well. Your client's happy. He says, hey, I want to do a review for you. You're going to have to ask them to cool their jets or pump the brakes or whatever metaphor you want to use until such time as that matter is wholly completed. So either the transaction that you've worked on is entirely closed, or the litigation you're working on is fully settled, or the judgment has been granted, or what have you. Just make sure that it's really clear that when you're getting a testimonial or an online review, that it's not for a pending matter. Now, that doesn't necessarily apply to when you're outsourced corporate counsel. If you are outsourced corporate counsel or something like that, where you're representing a client on a continuous basis, you can have an online review or a testimonial about how great you are, so long as that online review or testimonial does not rely upon or does not mention a matter that is still currently pending while at the time of posting the online review. Now, here's an example why you should always check your state. Now, I'm a New York attorney. I go with the ABA model rules and New York rules. But for those of you who are in other jurisdictions, always check your state. Here's a really good example. So New York Rule 7.1 is much more inclusive than the model rule about advertising. So in the state of New York, you have to put in the phrase, prior results do not guarantee similar outcome. You have to disclose that it's attorney advertising in big bold letters. You're not allowed to use trade names that imply results like lawyergetsmeallthemoney.com or something like that. You're not allowed to use actors in your commercials. Now, I personally don't do the commercial thing because it's just not my kind of practice, but that does happen sometimes. Folks are doing commercials for their law practice. You're not allowed to use actors. You're supposed to, at least in New York, you're supposed to use like the actual client, or you're also not allowed to have a non-attorney in the commercial pretending to be an attorney. And of course, those rules apply to online advertising as well. We live in the 21st century, and the online media is treated the same as other media. Now, moving on to the no contact rule, which I find endlessly fascinating just because of all the different times when I've had to deal with it. So, in representing a client under Model Rule 4.2, a lawyer cannot communicate about the subject of representation with the person the lawyer knows to be represented by another lawyer unless that lawyer has the consent of the other lawyer is authorized to do so by court order. So the authorized to do so by court order is pretty obvious, but in terms of the other stuff, generally speaking, when I'm dealing with a transaction, sometimes the other side will call me either to try to negotiate with me or for something else. If I don't know that they're represented, the first question I ask is, hi, are you represented by counsel? And if they say yes, say, hey, I'm not allowed to talk to you about this thing. Because of the no contact rule, it's a rule that exists to protect you specifically. So if you can please give me your attorney's contact information, I will call your attorney and then we can have a conversation. Now, alternatively, what you can do is say, okay, if you're represented by counsel, great, let's get that lawyer on the phone right now so we can have a conference call. Now, because generally speaking, it's going to be really hard to get the consent of the other attorney to speak with their client without them present. So don't even try to do that. Just get them on a conference call. It's usually the easiest way to go. Now, New York has an additional rule, so let's be clear on it. Notwithstanding the prohibitions on this previous paragraph and otherwise prohibited by law, a lawyer may cause a client to communicate with a represented person unless the represented person is not legally competent and may counsel the client with respect to those communications, provided the lawyer gives reasonable advance notice to the represented person's counsel. Now, this is something I actually surprisingly deal with all the time, especially in the transactional space where, you know, multiple sides of a transaction, they're having conversations with each other on a regular basis. So, and the your client will generally ask you, all right, well, how do I handle this? How do I handle that? And so if you are in that scenario, and this happens to me.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is SAUCE. S-A-U-C-E. SAUCE. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is SAUCE. S-A-U-C-E. SAUCE. Please take a moment and write this down.
All the time, what I generally do is say, usually at the beginning of a representation, when I find out about the other attorney, I let the other attorney know, okay, this is the kind of thing, the kind of situation where the clients are talking to each other all the time. I can't necessarily control it. I'm just letting you know that they, you know, let's say they're business partners or they're, you know, or they're in the same space. They're, you know, speaking with each other all the time. They may be talking with each other about the nature of this particular transaction, if they're negotiating and whatnot, and just let them know, let the other attorney know in writing so that they can be aware of it. That way you can do this, you know, in the real world and not break the rules. Now, moving on to referral fees. Rule 7.2, there is no model rule here. A lawyer shall not compensate or give anything of value to a person or organization to recommend or obtain employment by a client or as a reward for having made a recommendation resulting in employment by a client, except that a lawyer may refer clients to a non-legal professional, right, which is fine. They're allowed to do that, so long as they can include, they don't include any monetary or other tangible consideration or reward for that, or sharing of legal fees. I mean, that's really the thing that we're worried about. And the other one is sharing of legal fees between attorneys is okay, but you've got to make sure it's a true co-counsel kind of relationship. So what does that mean? Now, technically speaking, we're not allowed to share legal fees with anybody. However, there is this exception whereby attorneys who refer each other business can share legal fees if and only if, that IFF notation, the representation is being staffed by both attorneys. So what I generally tell folks when they're giving me a referral on other attorneys is, look, I'm not allowed to share legal fees. You know that, unless it's a real co-counsel relationship, this is what that looks like. If you're also communicating with the client along with me about this particular matter, if you are also reviewing the work product before it goes out, things of that nature, absolutely, I'm more than happy to share legal fees with you, and I'm estimating it's going to be X percent of each billable hour is, you know, how involved you are. And generally speaking, the other attorney's pretty happy about that. You also have to keep in mind that it needs to be commensurate to, you know, as I say, the referral fee, so to speak, needs to be commensurate with the level of involvement that the other attorney has. If you don't have that, then it's considered prohibited attorney legal fee sharing, and as they say, there be dragons, so avoid it. Now, referral services and prepaid legal. This is something that happens all the time. Rule 7.2b2 allows attorneys to, you know, be recommended or employed by or cooperate with, you know, the type of organization that promotes the use of lawyer services. So I'm not going to go, you know, through all the chapter and verse here. We're kind of running low on time. But, you know, legal aid office, military legal assistance office, or lawyer referral services, you know, those that are actually lawyer referral services that are registered as such, those are absolutely okay. But moving on to the more, what I think the more prevalent one is legal services membership programs like Rocket Lawyer, Legal Shield. I don't want to miss out on all of them here, LegalZoom, things like that. So they are a really great tool for obtaining clients. But in order to participate, Rule 7.2 has six conditions. You have to meet all of them. Let's go through them. One, the lawyer shall have initiated or promoted this organization for the primary purpose of providing financial or benefit to such lawyer. no problem. You're not doing it on behalf of someone else. You're trying to get yourself business, not someone else. The organization is not operated for the purpose of procuring legal work or financial benefit for a lawyer outside the legal services program. Again, pretty obvious. If that's their business model, it is what it is. The member or beneficiary who the legal services are furnished is recognized as a client of the lawyer. So it's not the kind of thing where the legal service membership program says, wait, you're our client and we're outsourcing this. It has to be a direct representation by the attorney involved. Legal service plan, such organization provides appropriate relief for any member or beneficiary who asserts improper and inadequate representation. That's, you know, rather obvious, and all the big folks do it. The lawyer does not know or have cause to know such organization is in violation of applicable laws, rules of court, or the legal requirements. So again, quite obvious. And finally, such organization is filed with the appropriate disciplinary authority in annual report. And that's pretty easy to check. Now that I've gone through all the chapter and verse, let's talk about referral fees in the real world. Because other industries and professions give referral incentives all the time, especially those that are in professional sales for products that, you know, for products and services that are not law or medical. So it's going to be expected by some folks. And when you're networking with people and they're saying, okay, what can I get? You know, what can I get for giving a referral fee, or how can we help each other in that regard? What do you do? Here are the four things that I generally like to do. First thing I do is I explain the rules that applies to attorneys. When you're dealing with a non-attorney, it's really easy to say, look, the rules exist in this particular way and they're applied in this particular way. I'm not allowed to give a referral fee. I'm not allowed to share fees. And number two, I say no amount of business is worth my license, because we spent a lot of time in school and took a ridiculous bar exam, and we have to take all these CLEs, you know, yay, CLEs, in order to keep our license. No amount of business is worth losing your license over. The third thing I say is I call an exchange of goodwill. I say, look, if you're sending things over to me, I'm going to consider sending things over to you. But really, at the end of the day, I'm going to send my clients or my contacts to people who I think are the right fit for that particular job. And I'm not and to be consistent, you don't take referral fees on the other side. Theoretically, you could. The rules do state that you're allowed to take a referral fee for referring a client over to a different kind of profession, or buying a product or what have you. You just have to make sure that the client's interests always come first. I generally don't do it, because if we call an exchange of goodwill, it really doesn't work. Say, well, it's an exchange of goodwill, and you can't take my money, but I can take your money. It doesn't really work for me. Hey, maybe it'll work for you, but that doesn't really work for me. Now, let's move on to non-legal services. Now, this is something that I started doing about a year ago. I noticed that there were a lot of services that I was looking to provide to businesses that weren't exactly legal in nature. Not to say they were illegal, that would be silly, but to say that they weren't, I wouldn't necessarily have to be an attorney in order to provide those services, and that the nature of the services, aren't really, legal advice in nature. Sometimes just general business advice. And so what I did was I opened up a separate entity specifically to handle consulting. So let's talk about, if you were to do this, and by the way, this is something that happens, at least here in New York, all the time. Attorneys are, many of us are entrepreneurial in nature, especially the solo practitioners like me. And we sometimes open other businesses, especially if an attorney has a different skill set that they already have from a previous profession, a previous career that they want to continue making money off of. Just as an example, I have a good friend who I went to law school with, who is a professional archivist, is also an attorney. So he has two separate businesses, one for the research and archivist activities, and the other one for the practice of law. So an attorney may offer non-legal type services like consulting without those activities being subject to the rules of professional responsibility, if and only if, said IFF again, the client does not reasonably believe that they are being represented by an attorney. Now, reasonably believe is a difficult thing, because unfortunately the rules of professional responsibility, along with every other type of self-regulatory set of rules, assumes that the general public is dumb as bricks. It is what it is. The question of reasonably believe they're being represented by an attorney is a little nebulous, but there are some techniques that you can use in order to make sure that anyone could reasonably believe that they're not being represented by an attorney by doing these services. So these four techniques I use personally, I find them very helpful. One, open a separate entity for your non-legal type service business. So for me, it's Thales Consulting LLC. It doesn't have the word law in it, doesn't have the word legal in it or anything like that. It's consulting, clear. Number two, sign non-disclosure agreements between your non-legal service client and your non-legal service company if it's required. Now, in business consulting, it's important to have an NDA with your clients because of the whole trade secret situation we were discussing earlier. But here's the thing. If you don't have your consulting entity sign a separate non-disclosure agreement with the client, then theoretically speaking, the trade secret type disclosure, in order to protect that client's interest, would have to rely on attorney-client privilege. Well, now you've mixed things, and that's a problem. So instead of saying, well, I'm an attorney, this is confidential anyway, which is, you know, not smart, you say, look, I happen to be an attorney. I happen to run a law practice. This is not my law practice. I am not your attorney. So we need to have a duty of non-disclosure for your trade secrets. Here's a non-disclosure agreement I would like you to review. Get your own counsel and sign. And usually they don't get their own counsel, but you have to let them know that they have the right to their own counsel. Now, number three, prominently disclaim any attorney-client relationship and any and all contracts with your non-legal service business and their clients. Big bold letters, you know, not attorney-client privilege, this is not an attorney-client relationship. You make sure it's fully disclaimed. And also what I do in my own personal ones, which may be overkill, but I still find useful, is to have the client initial a portion of the contract separately, which states that they fully understand that there's no attorney-client relationship between, you know, client and Todd Culkin as a person, that you're not being represented by an attorney in these services, and they've been briefed on the difference. You know, having them sign that as a separate matter on the same contract is generally very helpful. Now, one last one, which is a little you need to be careful. Don't mix your client base. Unless you reasonably believe that your independent judgment as an attorney representing the client would be completely unaffected by your non-legal service relationship. By the way, that is a paraphrasing of a New York opinion. And what it's essentially saying is, look, if you reasonably, you know, believe that your independent judgment is not going to be clouded by doing this other thing with your legal client, then you can do so. Here's the problem with that. And it's a similar problem to should you take equity, which is, yeah, you reasonably believe in X, Y, or Z. You do everything you can, but if the client's not happy later and they put in a complaint to the grievance committee, the grievance committee is probably going to find a problem with it. So I'm a little risk averse, so I say just don't do it. Have your consulting clients, your archivist clients, or whatever, not be your legal clients. But you could theoretically do it in certain situations. Now, moving on to something a little different, dealing with an unrepresented party. We talked about what it takes when you're dealing with someone who is represented, but what about when they're not represented? Now, just because they're unrepresented doesn't mean that they're not the general public and doesn't mean that they're not considered to be dumb as bricks, theoretically, you know, metaphorically speaking, by the rules of professional responsibility. So we have a separate rule for that. So Ronald Rule 4.3, a lawyer shall not state or imply that the lawyer is disinterested when they're dealing with a non-represented party. That's rather obvious. But you should definitely put in writing that you're not disinterested, that you are representing, you know, party X or party Y. When the lawyer knows, reasonably should know, that the unrepresented person misunderstands the lawyer's role, the lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to correct this understanding. Again, just do it in writing. Make sure you continue doing it in writing, especially if the unrepresented person is trying to, whether it's true ignorance or what I call willful ignorance or feigning of ignorance, say, oh, well, you're representing both of us, right? No. And finally, lawyers shall not give legal advice to an unrepresented person other than the advice to secure counsel. If the lawyer knows, or reason should know, that the interests of such person are or have a reasonable possibility of being conflict of interest with the client. You know what I would do if I were the folks who write the rules, and thank God I'm not the folks who write the rules. I would just end that sentence at other than the advice of secure counsel. Boom. That's it. Don't get legal advice to an unrepresented person other than go get your own lawyer, and you have the right to a lawyer. It's just easier that way. Now, doing a quick little example here. So we have a scenario. Company X is founded by two partners, A and B. You're represented to represent A in negotiations with B. How do you handle the negotiations if B is represented by counsel? Well, the no contact rule clearly applies. If B isn't represented by counsel, make sure that B understands, or you've told him in writing, that you represent A and that you do not represent him or her, you know, person B, and that they have the right to counsel and should seek counsel. And finally, if B lawyers up during the process, we switch from the unrepresented party rule to the no contact rule, and that applies. Now, moving on to trust account considerations. I see we've already gone over time here. Some of the stuff is still very important, but we can do this in a way that's a little expedited. So, trust account considerations, rule 1.15. Look, everyone knows not to commingle funds. There are other pitfalls you need to avoid, which aren't obvious. Let's just go through them quickly. Number one, never take cash out of the escrow account, even to give to a client. Always use a check or wire transfer. Now, rule 1.5 doesn't specifically say that. What it says is that you need to have a record of all transactions. So if a client says, look, I need to buy this thing and it involves cash, can I take it from my funds in the account? The answer is always yes, but what I'm going to have to do is write a check and you can cash the check. It's always, always, always the best answer. Number two, keep a ledger that shows the following. And this may not be entirely obvious. Obviously, you need to have records of each transaction, but you need to have more detail than, say, an accountant would need. So date of the transaction, the name of the client, the transactional funds, the amount, the purpose for the transaction, the source of funds, which is important for any money laundering purposes, and any other necessary information. Also make sure you keep copies of every check that you write. You keep PDF copies of every wire transfer receipt that you receive, things of that nature. Now finally, and this is not an ethics consideration, but it's still important to do it anyway. When you're using an IOLA or an IOLTA account, make sure that every escrow agreement that you write using that account have the clients waive the right to interest. And here's why. You know, IOLA and IOLTA accounts belong to the local pro bono fund. And any interest that's accrued on your client's money in the IOLA or IOLTA account is just given to the pro bono fund. Technically speaking, interest that is earned on a client's money should belong to the client, right? Unless you're dealing with an IOLA, IOLTA. So make sure that that's super clear to the client in writing, and prominent in your escrow agreement. You say, look, this is an IOLA account. It belongs to the local pro bono association, the pro bono fund. All the interest that accrues belongs to the pro bono fund, and therefore you waive the right to any interest. Trust me, if you are dealing with large transactions where large amounts of money stick in the account for, a month or two or even longer, this will be a boon to you. Next, rule 1.16, possibly my personal favorite, firing a client. Yes, the rules actually allow us to fire a client on occasion. So, a lawyer shall not represent a client or representations commence, shall withdraw from representation if, and there are a bunch of different ways to do it. So obviously, if it results in violation of rules of professional conduct, you can say no. If physical or mental condition, your physical or mental condition materially impairs the lawyer's ability to represent the client, again, obvious. Lawyer's discharged, meaning you're not an attorney anymore. Well, then you shouldn't be representing a client. Now, here's the part that matters to me. As a solo practitioner, I don't have as much cachet as a big firm. So, but sometimes I need to fire a client. So here are all of the reasons you're allowed to fire a client for. Really important. Number one, withdrawal can be accomplished without material adverse effect on the interests of the client. Great. If you think it's not going to harm them materially, you're good. Two, the client persists in the course of action involving lawyer services that the lawyer reasonably believes is criminal or fraudulent. You are, the client isn't God. You're allowed to say no. Number three, the client has used lawyer services to perpetuate a crime or fraud. If you figure that out, you can withdraw immediately without any repercussions whatsoever. In fact, it would be your duty to do so. Number four, the client insists on taking action the lawyer considers repugnant or with the lawyer has a fundamental disagreement. That, you know, your mileage may vary depending on what you consider repugnant or what where there's a fundamental disagreement, but, you know, to each their own. Number five, the client fails to substantially fulfill an obligation to the lawyer. Usually that means that, you know, they haven't paid. You have to give them reasonable notice that they'll withdraw unless the obligation is fulfilled. Now, this is a little more difficult for the litigators out there because they have to get a leave of court to withdraw, but you can, as a business attorney, you can written notice saying, look, I haven't been paid in XYZ days. You owe this amount. If you don't pay by this date, then I'm withdrawing as your attorney, and you're allowed to do it. Now, number six, the representation will result in an unreasonable financial burden on the lawyer or has been rendered unreasonably difficult by the client. This is a catch-all. Well, actually, number seven is the catch-all, but this is the closest thing to a real catch-all you're going to get, saying if the client is absolutely terrible, or they're forcing you to do things that are making you lose, you know, a significant amount of money on the representation, you know, don't do it. And finally, other good cause for withdrawal exists. There's your actual factual catch-all. Now, going through the end of 1.6 just briefly. You know, complying with applicable law requiring notice to a tribunal, that's for the litigators. You know, they need to leave a court to withdraw. And finally, when you terminate, the lawyer shall take steps to the extent reasonably practical to protect the client's interests. You know, give reasonable notice, give them time to get other counsel. You know, surrender your, surrender papers of property, which the client is entitled, refunding in advance payment, things like that. Remember, you're allowed to keep a copy of your file so that if you're ever audited later, you can have it. But make sure that that your now former client gets a copy of the file. Now, client is third party neutral. This happens sometimes, especially when you're dealing with what I call a business divorce, you know, a dissolution of a partnership or something like that. So, a lawyer serves as third party neutral. You know, unfortunately, we're not going to, and maybe fortunately for you folks listening, we're not going to go through all the chapter and verse on this one. Very clear, when you're a third party neutral, when you don't represent one side or the other, be clear about it. Put it in writing. Make sure that everyone understands you don't represent anybody. You're not on anybody's side here. You're just here to either arbitrate the thing or mediate the thing or what have you. If the clients are, they're unrepresented by other attorneys, let them know that they should understand that, you know, you're not their attorney. Always give that great legal advice that they should get an attorney, and also recognize and force them to recognize, especially in writing, the difference between the lawyer's role as third party neutral and the lawyer's role as one who represents a client. Now, finally, should you take equity? Now, this is something that happens in the startup world all the time. It's rather common that clients will offer equity in a company in exchange for legal services. Ask yourself, is there a conflict of interest associated with this? New York weighed in on this back in 2012, and they gave that sort of cop-out answer of, if you reasonably think it's not a conflict of interest, then it isn't for these purposes. However, that might become a weapon against you if there's a complaint to the Attorney Grievance Committee. So really do the analysis. Is there a conflict of interest? Balance the risk and reward of taking the equity, especially if you're dealing with a startup. The concept of supplemental fees is helpful. Sometimes you want to make sure that there's some skin in the game. You say, look, I'll give you a discount on my services if you also give me some equity and make sure the valuation makes sense. Now, the question, is it different if you're not counsel for the company? Absolutely. If you're a consultant for the company or something else, and you've done all of those things for a non-legal service type job that we discussed earlier, you know, the rules of professional responsibility don't apply to the situation. Now, as an alternative, there's something called phantom equity, whereby you as attorney get a piece of whatever the eventual exit is. That's generally helpful because it doesn't give the company a fiduciary duty to you since you are not a shareholder. If you have any more questions about that, you know, you can just let me know. And finally, you know, opinion 913 from 2012. It has not changed since then in New York. I have not seen a conflicting opinion in other states. Very simply, the rules that the committee is stating that if you reasonably believe that it's not a conflict of interest, then you can do it. Just keep in mind that what is considered reasonable to believe is a conflict of interest versus isn't is very different when you're staring down the barrel of the Attorney Grievance Committee. And that's it for me today. Sorry I went a little over, but this was all, I believe, really important information to go over. Thank you so much for listening today. If you have any questions, I absolutely adore hearing from folks who take my CLEs, whether you like it or not, whether you like the CLE or not, I'd love to hear from you. You can shoot me an email, todd@kulkinlaw.com. That's KulkinLaw.com. Or you can give me a call at 212-485-9884. With that, I'm Todd Culkin. This has been Ethics Law, Ethics in Business Law, and I will see you next time.